about generalizations of the ADS CFT correspondence to cases which are not ADS and also not CFTs, with the aim of using the ADS CFT correspondence to learn about QCD, as I'll describe in detail in the introduction. So I'll start with some introduction describing the setup and the motivations. And then I'll discuss three examples of generalizations of the ADS CFT correspondence, which can be used to teach us some things about QCD, and which involve either deformations or complexifications and cascades. So we'll cover each of these in turn. During these lectures, I won't have time to give any references, but most of the references can be found in these lecture notes for lectures that I gave in 2002, and also about 70% of the material that I'll cover is also covered in these lecture notes. So if you want to find references, then they should all be there. And also, please don't hesitate to stop me with questions at any time, either about the topics that I'm speaking about or about background that I'm assuming that you know and which maybe you don't know, so I'll be able to cover it. So you've already heard in this school several series of lectures about the ADS-CFT correspondence, but the ADS-CFT correspondence is just an example of a much more general correspondence between string theories and field theories. So as you probably know, historically, string theory originated not by trying to explain quantum gravity, but by trying to describe confining field theories. And in confining field theories, there are strings attaching charged particles, and at least there are effective strings. And one could wonder whether there could be a theory where these effective confining strings are the basic objects. And that was the original motivation for constructing string theory. And a more general relation between field theories and string theories was found by Etoft in the context of the larger limit. So again, as you've already heard in this school, if one constructs a larger limit of some SUN gauge theory while keeping fixed the Etoft coupling constant lambda, which is defined to be Jung-Mohl squared times n. So in this larger limit, the Feynman diagrams of the string of the large n field theory rearrange themselves in a way which can be interpreted as the Feynman diagrams of a string theory with a string coupling that goes like 1 over n. So this is a completely general phenomenon for any large n field theory. And so you've seen the example of this in the case of ADS-CFT, but this general correspondence, of course, has nothing to do with conformal invariance or with supersymmetry. We expect that any large n field theory should have a string theory dual of this type, again, just at least based on the diagrammatic analysis, which is relevant at weak coupling, but there are reasons to believe that it should work also at strong coupling. So that's the relation in one direction. And in the other direction, the claim that string theories should be related to field theories is, again, much more general than just the ADS-CFT case. We know that string theories always include quantum gravity. And quantum gravity theories have a property called holography, which means that the number of degrees of freedom in these theories does not scale like the volume, but rather it scales like the area of space. And that motivates conjecturing that at least some theories of quantum gravity might have some dual description as some field theory that lives on the boundary of the space. And in some cases, it might be a local field theory, like the ones that we're usually interested in. So quantum gravity in some spaces might be expected just because of holography to be related to a field theory. And again, you've heard about how this works in anti-de Sitter space, but this is again a much more general phenomenon, which is supposed to be true in many spacetimes. So from both of these points of view, there's nothing really special about ADS spaces or about conformal field theories. The only thing that's really special about ADS-CFT is that that's really the first example where these very general considerations were made precise and where there was really a concrete proposal for a specific field theory mapping to a specific string theory. Of course, these general considerations are very general and do not give any hint a priori about, given some large n field theory, what is the string theory that should be dual to it and vice versa. So it's good to have specific examples. And the first example that was really well understood, at least above two dimensions in the field theory side, is the example of the ADS-CFT correspondence. And that tells us that whenever we have a quantum gravity theory on anti-de Sitter space, it's dual to some conformal field theory. And the especially interesting case, which you've heard about in the school, is the case of type 2B string theory on a five-dimensional anti-de Sitter space across a five-sphere, which is dual to the n equals 4 supersymmetric SUN gauge theory. And one of the nice things about this specific example of the ADS-CFT correspondence and of this general relation between string theories and field theories is that in this special example, there is actually a continuous parameter which one can vary on both sides of this correspondence. So from the point of view of the Young-Mills theory, this parameter is the Sittrift coupling lambda, which is G Young-Mills squared n. So in most field theories, we don't have a continuous parameter because of dimensional transmutation that transforms the coupling constant into a scale. But in the n equals 4 Young-Mills theory, the coupling constant does not run, so one really has a continuous parameter, a continuous dimensionless parameter, which one can vary, which is this Hooft coupling. And so this, in general, the parameters are n if you want, and this Hooft coupling that completely specifies the theory. And this parameter maps on the string theory side to the string coupling up to a factor of n. And also on the string side, we have here the dilaton in this ADS5 process 5 space, which we can freely vary. And the advantage of having a continuous parameter like this that we can vary is that we can look at different limits of this parameter. So for instance, we can look what happens when this parameter is very small. So when this parameter is small, perturbation theory is valid here on the field theory side. So the field theory side is weakly coupled, and we can do any computations that we want on this side. However, on the string theory side, the same limit maps to a very strongly curved space because this parameter lambda is also the radius of ADS space to the fourth over alpha prime squared, so that when lambda is small, the curvatures are very large here. But in this limit, we can use if we want, we can do computations on the weakly coupled field theory side and use this to learn about gravity on this strongly curved manifold. And in the opposite limit of lambda going to infinity, the field theory is very strongly coupled, and we basically have almost no tools on the field theory side to do computations in this theory. But the gravity side in this case, or the string theory side, is a weakly curved background because the radius of the ADS space is much bigger than the string scale. And because it's weakly curved, we can use a supergravity approximation. And that approximation is valid for many computations. And this means that in this limit of lambda going to infinity, we can use supergravity to learn many things about this strongly coupled n equals 4 Young-Mills theory. And you've probably heard about various computations of this type in the previous lectures of the school. Now, we don't always have a parameter like this that enables us to do such an extrapolation. In other examples of the ADS-CFT correspondence, sometimes we don't have a parameter like this. But it's, of course, very nice to have such a parameter because that enables us to interpolate between a regime where we can really use field theory to do computations and an opposite regime where we can use supergravity to do computations. And the ADS-CFT correspondence, in terms of this coupling constant lambda, is really a strong weak coupling duality, as is obvious from this correspondence. But one should bear in mind that even though in terms of lambda it's just strong weak coupling duality, then on both sides there's also another expansion parameter, which is 1 over n here and z string here. And in terms of this 1 over n expansion, actually weak coupling maps to weak coupling on both sides. So here one has the 1 over n expansion, and here one has the string loop expansion. And in terms of this expansion, then, in the Larsen limit, one has weak coupling on both sides. But in terms of this additional expansion parameter lambda, we have this strong weak coupling duality. Now, so as I mentioned, using just the ADS-CFT correspondence, we can use supergravity or weakly curved string theory to teach us about this strongly coupled n equals 4 Young-Mills theory. So that's very interesting from the field theory point of view, that we can learn about this strongly coupled field theory. But of course, the n equals 4 super Young-Mills theory is not very interesting phenomenologically. A question which is more interesting phenomenologically is to learn about the theories which participate in the standard model. So as you know, the standard model gauge group is U1 cross SU2 cross SU3. The first two factors here, the U1 and the SU2, are weakly coupled at all energy scales, in the case of the U1 theory because it's not asymptotically free, and in the case of the SU2 theory because it's broken at a relatively high energy scale. So in the standard model, one can use perturbation theory to learn about the properties of these two gauge group factors. But the SU3 factor, which is called QCD, is not Higgs, then it is asymptotically free. So the coupling, the random coupling constant in this theory means that we have weak coupling at higher energies in QCD, but we have strong coupling at lower energies. So if this is some energy scale, then as we run down in energies, the coupling constant becomes strong around some scale, which is usually called lambda QCD, where the coupling constant is of order one. And so we can use perturbation theory to learn about higher energy properties of QCD, like deep inelastic scattering and so on. But we cannot use perturbation theory to learn about the strong coupling properties of the theories. And it's really the strong coupling properties of the theory which are most easily accessed experimentally. For instance, many of the qualitative features of the theory, like the fact that it has confinement, the fact that it has a mass gap, the fact that if we add flavors, we have chiral symmetry breaking, the fact that we have some very intricate spectrum of mesons and baryons in this theory, and so on. So all these things we cannot see using perturbation theory. In perturbation theory, we don't see any sign of these things. So these are really strong coupling phenomena in QCD. And obviously, if we want to use QCD to do computations, for instance, to compute the spectrum of, well, the mass of the proton and various other things like that, we need to have some control over these strong coupling phenomena in QCD. One way to do this, of course, is to go to a computer, put the theory on a computer, and do a lattice simulation. So that's sort of the brute force approach. But the hope is that there should also be some analytic way to control this strong coupling limit and to show that QCD has all these properties and to find some systematic way to compute the spectrum of the mesons and baryons of QCD. Now, of course, this is a very hard problem that people have been struggling with for more than 30 years now. But from what I've described before, there is a hope that this problem should become easier if we take n to infinity. Now, at first sight, from the field theory point of view, things don't really become simpler when one takes n to infinity. One still has this random coupling, and one still has strong coupling at lower energies. And it seems like even in the larger limit, one still has all these mysterious properties of confinement and so on, which are not visible in perturbation theory. However, as I've mentioned, in the n to infinity limit, from a Tufts analysis, we believe that QCD should be described by a weakly coupled string theory, by which I mean a theory in which the string coupling is small. Of course, it could still live on a very weakly curved space, as I've mentioned here. And so there should be some theory which is dual to, well, some string theory which is dual to large n QCD, in the same sense of the duality between string theory and field theory in this ADS-CFT correspondence. And the hope is that in this weakly coupled string theory, all of these properties will be obvious. So confinement should certainly be obvious in a dual string theory because one should be able to directly see the confining string, which attaches any two external charges. And one should be able to, in such a string theory, one should be able to systematically compute the spectrum and the mass gap and so on in this theory in the large n limit. And then presumably, if one understands this string theory well enough, one should also be able to do the 1 over n expansion, include the string loop corrections, and go all the way to n equals 3, which is what we're really interested in for phenomenology. So the main question that we'll be asking in these talks is, how do we find this string theory which describes QCD in the large n limit? I mean, obviously, eventually we'll want to also put in the 1 over n corrections, but the first question is obviously just to find the theory that describes QCD in the large n limit. And so that will be the goal of these talks. Now, the large n limit, when one takes the large n limit, then the quarks in QCD become negligible, assuming that one takes large n with fixed number of flavors as usual. So this large n limit can be taken to be just a pure SUN gauge theory or pure SUN Yang-Mills theory. Later on, one can also add flavors to that if one wants, but the flavors have a negligible effect in the large n limit because they're suppressed by power of 1 over n. So the first thing that one needs to do to solve large n QCD is just to solve the pure Yang-Mills theory, and then one can always add flavors later. So in my talk, I'll discuss several approaches to finding this theory and also to finding a closely related theory, which is the n equals 1 supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory, which hopefully you heard about as the lecture is about supersymmetry in this school. So the n equals 1 supersymmetric theory is the same as taking pure Yang-Mills theory, but adding also a Dirac fermion in the adjoint representation. So, of course, because it has this additional fermion, this theory is not directly related to QCD, but it has many of the same qualitative properties. It exhibits these phenomena of confinement, a mass gap, chiral symmetry breaking, and so on, which are also not visible in perturbation theory, but which should be visible in this dual string theory in the large n limit. So as a first toy model, one might hope to maybe find the string dual of this n equals one supersymmetric theory and then move on to the case with no supersymmetry, because of course having supersymmetry is very useful and constraining, as you've seen in previous lectures in this school. So the main goal will be to find this large n string theory. And of course, the first thing which one may hope is that one could hope that maybe this large n string theory could have a good supergravity approximation, like the n equals four, like the dual of the n equals four theory does for strong coupling. So one might hope that maybe large n QCD could have perhaps a supergravity dual, and then it would be easy to do computations, because we could do them just using supergravity, and we would not have to bother with solving string theory in strongly curved backgrounds, which is a very difficult problem. However, it's easy to argue that, in fact, it's not possible that the string dual to large n QCD will have a supergravity approximation, meaning that it will be weakly curved. So one reason for this is that, as we mentioned, QCD becomes weakly coupled at high energies, and it seems clear that just a supergravity description will not be able to capture a weakly coupled theory. Also, in the ADS-CFT, in order to describe the weakly coupled theory, one has to go to strong curvatures. But a more general reason why QCD could never have just a supergravity dual is that whenever one discusses a supergravity theory, one is really discussing a theory that has two different sets of scales. There is some scale which involves the supergravity modes, and there is a scale which is related to the string excitations. And the meaning of having a supergravity approximation is that there should be some separation between these two scales. So there should be some scale lambda, which is the typical scale, the typical mass scale associated with the masses and interactions of the supergravity modes. And there should be some other scale, say, of string, which governs the masses and interactions and so on of the stringy modes. And in a supergravity approximation, of course, the scale set by the supergravity fields should be much smaller than the scale of the stringy excitations. Otherwise, one could not, in a useful way, decouple the gravity modes and discuss their interactions separately, as one wants to do in a supergravity approximation. So whenever we have a supergravity theory that describes some confining background with a mass gap, then there's always some low energy scale lambda, which is related to the mass gap and which gives the mass of the low energy supergravity modes, and a separate scale M string, which is related to the string tension. So this of course, is just the square root of the string tension. And there is a big separation between these scales. On the other hand, in QCD, we don't expect to have any large separation between these scales because we don't have any dimensionless parameter that we can tune to get such a separation. QCD is famous for having no dimensionless parameters. And well, in particular, when we take it into infinity, we don't have any dimensionless parameters. So in QCD, there's no reason to expect that the strong coupling scale of the theory, which determines the mass gap and the spectrum of particles, should be about of the same order as the square root of the confining string tension. So there's no reason to expect such a separation of scales, and therefore there's no reason to expect to have any good supergravity approximation to the theory. So there is a big qualitative difference between theories that have a supergravity approximation and which therefore have two mass scales in them, one which determines the mass scales of the supergravity modes, and these modes all have spin less than or equal to two. So in such theory, the masses of all states would spin less than, well, there are some light states, but all of them have spin less than or equal to two. And then there's a difference scale that sets the masses of the string excitations. And for example, all particles that have spin bigger than two are all not included in supergravity, so they're all necessarily string excitations in this mapping, and their masses would all be set by this much higher scale. While in QCD, of course, we don't expect any fundamental difference between the mass scales that are associated with particles of spin two or three. So what this means is that the large n dual to QCD, again, is necessarily not going to be supergravity. It has to be a very strongly curved background. where we don't have this separation between supergravity modes and other excited string modes. And of course, this poses a problem for us because we don't have really good methods to study string theory in strongly curved spaces. So there are basically two directions which one could go from here. I mean, starting from this negative result, there are two directions to go in. So one direction would be to study string theory in strongly curved backgrounds with Ramon-Ramon fields and so on, and to try to understand them better. And that's, of course, a very interesting direction, but I won't be discussing it here in the school. The other direction which one might try to go in is to say that even though large N QCD itself does not have a good supergravity approximation, perhaps one could modify this theory a little bit and find a theory that does have a good supergravity approximation, and perhaps one could do this without changing all these interesting qualitative strong coupling properties of the theory, as I discussed. So what we'll be trying to do is we want to construct a theory that looks like QCD at lower energies, but then there is some other scale, lambda nu, where we add some new degrees of freedom to the theory. And we'll see that it is possible to add some new degrees of freedom to QCD in such a way that the theory that involves also the new degrees of freedom will have a good supergravity approximation, and then we will be able to do useful computations in that theory, even without solving or making progress on understanding string theory in strongly curved backgrounds. Once we introduce this new scale, of course, we have some dimensionless parameter, which is the ratio between these two scales. Or alternatively, we could take this new dimensionless parameter to be the Schuft coupling at the scale lambda nu. So if this lambda nu is much higher than the QCD scale, then the Schuft coupling at that scale would be small, because by definition, the scale lambda QCD is the scale where the Schuft coupling becomes one, and at much higher scales, this lambda is much smaller than one. So we could add these degrees of freedom at a much higher scale than QCD. So when we're working in this limit where lambda nu is much bigger than lambda QCD, then of course below the scale lambda nu, we do get just QCD. So the low energy theory in this limit. So at low energies in this case, we do get QCD as we want to. But of course that means that in this limit we won't really be able to describe the theory using supergravity because as we said, QCD itself cannot have a supergravity approximation. But we'll find that there are other limits that in the same theory, just by tuning this dimensionless parameter of the ratio between lambda nu and lambda QCD, or this coupling constant lambda, if we take the opposite limit where lambda nu is of the same order as lambda QCD and this Schuft coupling is of order one, then we'll see that we can, by an appropriate choice of what these new degrees of freedom are, we will be able to find theories where in this limit, the theory does have a supergravity approximation. And so moreover, in all these constructions, we will have this dimensionless parameter, either small lambda or the ratio of these two scales, just like we had in N equals 4 Young-Mills theory, and like we did not have in QCD. So we're going to build theories that have this additional dimensionless parameter. And then, as is clear from this discussion, this parameter will have two different limits. In one limit, we will be able to use supergravity to describe the theory. But in the other limit of the same parameter, we'll have a theory which reduces to QCD at lower energies. And then even though we'll only be able to do computations in this limit of large lambda, which we'll describe by supergravity, the hope will be that the qualitative properties of the theory do not depend strongly on this lambda. So even though obviously the result of any specific computation that we do could depend on what this parameter lambda is, then as we'll see, at least in some cases, the qualitative properties will not depend on lambda. So we'll be able to see, even in this limit of strong lambda, we'll be able to see all these interesting properties like confinement, a mass gap, and so on, just by using supergravity. And then we'll have to wave our hands and hope that the same properties will continue to hold also for small lambda, and at least we'll be able to understand them qualitatively by understanding the properties in this limit and then just saying that as we continue lambda to small values, the same explanations should describe these properties also in QCD itself. So of course, an example of a specific property that will depend on lambda is this ratio of mass scales. So we know that in this limit, where the low energy limit is QCD, then we know that lambda QCD is about the same order as the confining string tension. Well, in this limit, we know that the confining string tension is much bigger than lambda QCD. So the ratio between these two scales obviously will be some function of lambda that will vary considerably when we go from small to large lambda. But again, the qualitative properties of the theory will hopefully not depend on lambda. And that's more or less the best we can hope for in terms of describing in learning about QCD from supergravity. So again, of course, the right thing to do is to really tackle string theory in strongly curved backgrounds directly and solve it. But so far, not much progress has been made on that. So in the absence of a solution to that problem, the best we can do is to study supergravity backgrounds, which are continuously related to QCD in this way. So that's so that will be the goal of the set of talks. So I'll describe three examples of theories in this general class where we have a dimensionless parameter such that in one limit the theory becomes QCD at low energies, and in the other limit the theory has a good supergravity approximation. And we'll see that at least in these lower to lambda limits, we will be able to understand all these mysterious strong coupling properties of QCD. So are there any questions about this general plan? Okay, so if there are no questions, let's start with the examples. So so the example that you saw up to now of the duality between string theory and field theory was in the case of a conformal field theory where there's no running coupling and no scale dependence. And of course, in large N QCD, there is a very strong scale dependence. So we have to find a way to generalize the ADS CFT correspondence to theories that do have a scale dependence. So how can we find the string theory dual of theories that do have a scale dependence? Well, the easiest thing to do is to start from the theories that we already understand and then somehow make small changes to them and try to get theories that will resemble QCD. So there are three general ways to do that. The first way that I'll describe is deformations. So we can always start from a conformal theory and then deform the theory by breaking conformal invariants explicitly by adding to the Lagrangian various relevant operators. And if we do this in an appropriate way, as we'll see, then we can create, then obviously we break conformal invariants, and on the gravity side, we will not be in anti-de Sitter space anymore. And by choosing our deformations appropriately, we will be able to flow to QCD like theories at low energies. So that's one way to get non-conformal theories by generalizing the ADS CFT correspondence. And in this context, I'll focus on the background that was first found by Polsinski and Strassler. Another way to get non-conformal theories is, I should have mentioned that one thing we need to generalize from the usual ADS CFT correspondence is that we need to break conformal invariants, but we also need to break supersymmetry, because in the usual ADS CFT correspondence, of course, we have 16 supercharges. Well, we want to break this to either 4 supercharges for n equals 1 igmals or no supercharges. So we also have to break supersymmetry. One way to break scale invariants without breaking supersymmetry is just to look at the near horizon limit of other D-brains, which are not D3 brains. And this gives us the string theory duals of various non-conformal theories that have 16 supercharges. And then if we start from such a theory in higher dimensions, we can compactify it in a way such that the compactification will break supersymmetry and also break conformal invariants, because it explicitly introduces a scale of the compactification manifold. And so in this way, we'll be able to start from higher dimensional theories that have maximal supersymmetry, and by compactifying, break both conformal invariants and supersymmetry and get to a four-dimensional theory that will resemble QCD. And the main example of this that we'll discuss is the background that was constructed by Maldacena and Nunez. And the final example that we'll discuss is an example where one doesn't start from some maximally supersymmetric theory, but one tries to directly, in string theory, construct some brain configuration that will not be conformally invariant at low energies. And this will lead us to discussing duality cascades, where the main example is the background that was constructed by Klebanov and collaborators, and in its final form by Klebanov and Strassler. So in these three lectures, I'll discuss in turn each of these different approaches to finding a string theory dual to QCD in this sense of finding a string theory background that has a continuous parameter such that in one limit it gives us QCD and in the other limit it has a good supergravity approximation. And as we'll see, each of these approaches has its advantages and disadvantages as a method for studying the large, the string dual of large N QCD. So are there any questions before we move to discussing the first example? Okay, the first example, as I said, we want to take a conformal theory we want to start from some conformal theory for which we already know the string theory dual by the ADS-CFT correspondence, and then explicitly break conformal invariants in such a way that will lead us to QCD. And the simplest thing to start from is just to start from this example that I just erased of the N equals 4 superangles theory in 4 dimensions, which is dual to type 2B string theory on ADS 5 cross S 5. The field content of the N equals 4 supersymmetric Young-Mills theory includes a gauge field, it includes 4 fermions, and it includes 6 scalar fields. All of these in the adjoint representations, and the N equals 4 Young-Mills Lagrangian also includes various Yukawa couplings and quartic couplings between the scalars in this theory. Now, if we want to flow from this to pure Young-Mills theory, so in pure Young-Mills theory, we want to keep just this gauge field and throw away all the other degrees of freedom. So at first sight, it looks like there's an obvious way to do that. All we need to do is to add masses to these other fields. We add masses for these fermions and for the scalars. So say we deform our Lagrangian by adding m squared times a mass term for all these scalars and m times a mass scale for all these Luinos. And naively, one might think that after a deformation like this, then all these fields, phi and lambda, would get a mass. And at low energies, we'd be left just with a pure Young-Mills theory. Or if we want to remain with the n equals 1 supersymmetric Young-Mills theory, then we have to keep one of these lambdas massless and give a mass to all the other fields. And it looks like in this way, we can easily flow to a theory that will resemble either the n equals 0 or the n equals 1 Young-Mills theory. It turns out that there's a problem with this naive analysis, and the problem involves asking whether these deformations are really relevant deformations or not. Of course, if we start from a conformal theory and deform it, we can only deform by a relevant operator. We cannot deform by irrelevant operators because that's all defined. At weak coupling, both of these deformations are relevant. Of course, at weak coupling, this operator has dimension 2. The scalars are just canonically normalized scalars that have dimension 1, and this operator has dimension 3. So with weak coupling, both of these deformations are relevant. But however, we want to study this. Because we want to use supergravity, then we actually want to do this deformation in the opposite limit of large lambda, because we know that for small lambda, even this N equals 4 Young-Mills theory is not well approximated by gravity. So obviously, if we want to have any hope of describing the resulting theory by gravity, we'd better be in this opposite limit of large lambda, where here lambda is now just this coupling constant of the N equals 4 Young-Mills theory that we start with at high energies. So we need to ask whether this deformation is also relevant in the limit of large lambda or not. Now, I'm not sure if you've discussed this in the previous lectures or not, but the operators of the N equals 4 super Young-Mills theory are divided into two classes of operators. Some of the operators have dimensions which are protected by supersymmetry. They are operators that are called chiral primary operators, for which the supersymmetry algebra determines their dimension in terms of the R symmetry representation that the fields live in. And because it's just determined by the representation, then these fields do not have any anomalous dimensions. So some of the operators in this theory are chiral primary operators. And in this N equals 4 Young-Mills theory, the operators which are chiral primaries are operators which are a product of scalar fields, where the indices are multiplied in order to form a symmetric traceless representation of SO6. So it turns out that whenever one takes these indices in a symmetric traceless manner, so just chooses the indices to be symmetric and subtracts the traces under any two indices which are contracted, it turns out that that gives an operator which sits in a smaller presentation of supersymmetry whose dimension is protected. So these operators have dimension equals to k in the weak coupling theory. And because their dimension is protected, then that continues to be true also at strong coupling. And of course, one can then act with various supercharges on this theory. So it can act with some string of Qs on these and create other elements in the same representation whose dimensions are also protected because they're in the same representation. But all other operators, which are not descendants of these operators by acting with the supercharges, so all other operators, their dimension is not protected and in general gets corrections. So for instance, an example of an operator which is not chiral is this operator trace phi I phi I with a sum over I, because this is obviously not traceless. In fact, it's just the trace part of this SO6 representation. So this operator has dimension 2 at weak coupling, but then the dimension starts getting corrections. So there is some correction at leading order in lambda, lambda squared, and so on. And one can compute these corrections in perturbation theory. Now, this operator trace lambda lambda actually turns out to be a descendant of trace phi, of the traceless trace phi squared. So I can write it as in terms of two supercharges acting on trace phi phi, where here I multiply the indices in a symmetric traceless manner. So this operator actually is a chiral operator, and its dimension remains 3, also its strong coupling. So we can use it to deform the theory. However, this operator is not chiral. So a priori, we don't know what its dimension is in the large n limit. However, as you've heard, at large lambda, we can just use supergravity to describe this theory. So we can ask, so we can try to use supergravity to compute the dimensions of this operator. And it turns out that all these chiral primary operators map to fields that appear in the spectrum of supergravity, so just in the spectrum of type 2b supergravity on ADS5 cross S5. So that spectrum includes all these chiral operators and their descendants. And of course, if you compute the dimension using supergravity, you find exactly the same dimension, which is guaranteed by the field theory analysis. But all the non-chiral operators do not appear in supergravity, so they don't map to supergravity fields. And that means that they necessarily map to string excitations. So they necessarily map to fields living on anti-de-Sitter space whose mass is at least of order the string scale, 1 over square root alpha prime. And then if you translate this to a dimension by the standard formulas of the ADS CFT correspondence, which you've hopefully seen, then this implies that the dimension of these operators grows for strong coupling at least as fast as, well, as lambda to the 1/4. So at strong coupling, the dimension of these operators becomes very large. So this has a dimension of the order of lambda to the 1/4. And this means that we have two problems in trying to write down a deformation like this of the n equals 4 theory. One problem is that this operator is not relevant, so we can't really add it to the Lagrangian. And that it doesn't even make sense to add it at strong coupling. And the other problem is that even if we wanted to add it, this field does not map to a supergravity field. So as I hope you've seen, all of these single trace operators just map to supergravity fields. And as I'll describe in a few minutes, we know how to deform by these operators. That's just some operation that we need to do in the supergravity approximation. And we know how to do it, and we know how to describe a deformation by these fields just by using supergravity. But this field maps to a string mode. And obviously, because it maps to a string mode, even if we could perform this deformation, we could not describe it just using supergravity. We would have to include also string theory and involve this excited string mode. So it's just not possible to perform this deformation in the context that we're interested in of describing a theory just by supergravity. So that means that we have to settle just for performing this deformation by only adding the fermion mass terms. However, this is not really as bad as it seems, because even if in the leading order, we can only add mass terms for the fermions. So at the leading order, so well, here I wrote down equal masses, but of course, we could also add unequal masses, and we can always diagonalize the mass matrix of the fermions so that our deformation will take the form of adding to the CFT Lagrangian some, say, M1 times trace lambda 1 lambda 1 plus M2 trace 2 lambda 2 plus M3 times the third fermion. And then if we want to give a mass to the fourth fermion, then also some mass for the fourth fermion. So So as I mentioned, this is really the only deformation that we could do at the leading order. However, after we give a mass to the fermions, then generally that will induce also a mass to the scalar field. Certainly, if we break supersymmetry, then nothing protects the scalar fields anymore from getting a mass. So this deformation generally will give a mass also to the scalar field. So this usually does lead to some induced scalar mass. For instance, this induced mass could come from loop corrections. Once we've given a mass to the fermions, then we will, in general, have some induced scalar masses. And these masses also just come from operator mixings. After we added the mass, then the operator M phi phi has the same quantum numbers as the operator lambda lambda, and there could be some mixing between these two operators that will also induce some mass for the scalar field. I guess there's something that I should have mentioned before that, which you should have asked about, which is that even though, as I mentioned, we cannot add this mass, this uniform mass term for all the scalars because that's not a relevant deformation, a strong coupling. We could try instead of this to add a mass term that would be proportional to one of these trace phi I phi j in a way which is traceless and symmetric, and then that would be a relevant deformation. So this, in principle, we could add with some matrix mij squared. However, the problem with this deformation is that this mass squared matrix has to be traceless, which means that some of its eigenvalues, well, if some of its eigenvalues are positive, then some of the other eigenvalues have to be negative. And then, obviously, if we add a deformation like that, then some of the scalars become tachyonic modes and the theory becomes unstable. So this deformation we cannot add because it's not relevant, while this deformation we cannot add because it would lead to an instability. So this would always lead to tachyons because this matrix has to be traceless. However, as I mentioned, once we add this fermion mass deformation at the leading order, then we will induce some scalar masses, and these scalar masses could be, well, either proportional to this phi I phi I or to this phi I phi j. Of course, one has to worry that these induced scalar masses in some cases could perhaps be tachyonic. So nobody, if we break supersymmetry, nobody guarantees that the masses that we induce for the scalars couldn't be, well, the masses squared couldn't be negative, and in some cases they could be negative. So that's something that we have to worry about. And well, the simplest way to ensure that we don't get any tachyonic scalars after doing this deformation is to preserve supersymmetry. So the simplest case to analyze is the case where we do this deformation in a way that preserves n equals one supersymmetry. And as I mentioned, this case is interesting in its own right because it could lead us to flow to the n equals one supersymmetric Young-Mills theory at low energies, which is also an interesting theory in its own right and exhibits all these interesting qualitative properties of confinement and a mass gap. So if you want to preserve n equals one supersymmetry, then obviously this fourth mass term has to be zero because we have to leave some massless adjoint fermion that should be in the same n equals one multiplet as the gauge field. And we also have to, of course, tune the scalar masses so that they'll be related to the fermion masses. And the way to do this is just to deform this, to add these mass terms by adding a superpotential to the supersymmetric field theory. So as you've probably seen, the n equals one supersymmetric Young-Mills theory, or sorry, the n equals four supersymmetric Young-Mills theory, it can either be described using these components, but it can also be described by n equals one superfield, which include the gauge multiplet and three chiral multiplets, phi one, phi two, and phi three, in the adjoint representation. So this W alpha includes the gauge field and one of the four fermions, and the other three fermions and six real scalars are all inside these three chiral superfields, phi, in the adjoint representation, which each have a lowest component, which is a complex scalar, and also include one fermion. And then one can summarize all the interactions of the n equals four Young-Mills theory by a superpotential of the form, well, I'll write them with lower indices, it doesn't matter, phi one times the commutator of phi two and phi three. So this superpotential summarizes in some specific normalization that I chose for the kinetic terms of these fields, it summarizes all the interactions of the n equals four Young-Mills theory. And then if we want to do a mass deformation that preserves supersymmetry, then all we need to do is to add superpotential mass terms, so we can add M1 times trace phi one squared, M2 trace phi two squared, and m3 raised by 3 squared. So if we take a deformation like this, then if you expand it to leading order, so at leading order in the deformation, this only induces fermion masses. So it's of this general form that we've described before, except just with three masses, masses for three of the fermions and not for all four. But if we write this in this explicitly supersymmetric way, then we're ensured that the induced scalar masses will actually be equal to the fermion masses because that's determined by supersymmetry. And in particular, we're ensured that there are no tachyons. So this is the easiest way to make sure that this deformation that is stable and does not lead to any tachyons. Although, of course, again, in principle, this is just the simplest case, and I could also try to do this by breaking supersymmetry, and in some cases that might lead to tachyons, but in other cases it won't, and I'll discuss also that, but I'll start by just focusing on this simplest case where we do preserve n equals one supersymmetry, and that's, as I mentioned, it's the simplest way to guarantee stability. So this is the theory that I'll focus on for the rest of these lectures. And of course, we want all three of these masses to be non-zero. So we want M1, M2, M3 to be non-zero. We could study also the theory where we add only some of the mass terms, but in those cases, of course, we have no reason to expect that at low energies, the theory will resemble QCD. And indeed, it turns out that if we add only one or two mass terms, then the theory at low energies is completely different from QCD. If we add just one mass term, the theory flows to a conformal theory at low energies. And if we add two mass terms, then it flows to a theory that has a Coulomb branch and massless U1 fields at low energies. So really the minimal amount of masses that we can add and still have a theory that would be in the same universality class as the n equals one or as QCD is to really add three masses or four masses, as I mentioned. But if we have supersymmetry, the only case is to add three masses, and that's the case that I'll describe here. So are there any questions so far? Yes. Sorry? What do they do? Is that that? Right, so this term indeed induces a mass for the scalars, and in fact you might worry because it looks like, for instance, if all these masses are equal, then the mass which is induced for the scalars is exactly of this form. So you might worry about how that's consistent with what we said before. And the resolution of this is that really once we add these mass deformations, then there is an operator mixing. So even though for the theory with zero mass, then these operators are in separate multiplets. Once we add the mass term, then the multiplets mix together, and these fields are no longer in separate multiplet, but the operator lambda lambda itself also picks up a piece which is proportional to m phi phi, and that's how it's possible for this. That's why it's possible at the second order in the mass for this deformation to also induce a mass term for the scalars, even though if we would have tried to directly turn on such a mass, that would have been impossible. But because this term, as a term in the Lagrangian, is of higher order than this massless fermion term, then it can really get contributions which involve these operator mixings, which happen at first order in the mass. And so one can show that, so of course, you all know, I hope by now, how to write down the exact Lagrangian that is relevant for, well, that comes from this deformation and components. And indeed, it has such scalar mass terms, which you can write down explicitly, but by virtue of having turned on at first order some very specific fermion masses, then the scalar masses that you end up with at second order are indeed consistent with this being a relevant deformation and a deformation that one can consistently study. And of course, one also has supersymmetry here to guarantee that none of these things are renormalized and that one can really compute the scalar masses and see to what extent this theory really leads at low energies to a theory that resembles the Young-Mills theory, and that's what I'll do in a moment. So, any other questions? OK. Okay, so the first thing I want to do with this deformation is to study it on the field theory side. So of course, eventually we'll want to also study this deformation on the string theory side of the ADS-CFT correspondence. But let me start by studying it on the field theory side. And of course, the question is whether this deformation really leads us at low energies to the pure n equals 1 super Young-Mills theory. So naively, what you would say is that when you add this deformation, then all the scalars, well, all the scalars and 3 out of the 4 fermions get masses which are of order m. And so you might think that at energies that are much smaller than the scale of the masses, one would be left just with the massless fields, which are the gauge field and one of the fermions. And that's exactly the field fundament of the n equals 1 super Young-Mills theory. So naively, this deformation does exactly what we want. And of course, if we had 4 fermions, we'd end up to 4 fermion masses, we'd end up just with n equals 0 Young-Mills theory. So it looks like this does exactly what we want. However, we have to be more careful because, as we know, this n equals 1 super Young-Mills theory is itself a confining theory that dynamically generates some scale lambda super Young-Mills. And we have to be careful about what's the relation between this scale and the scale of the masses. And this picture of really getting the n equals 1 super Young-Mills theory is only true if the mass scale of this, if the dynamical mass scale of this n equals 1 Young-Mills theory is much smaller than the scale of these masses. And it's not hard to actually compute what this dynamically generated mass scale is. We just have to follow the running coupling constant. So if we, again, if we look at the running coupling constant as a function of the energy, so at high energies, the coupling constant just doesn't run because we have the n equals 4 Young-Mills theory. But then as we go down in energy, we start encountering these different masses, M3, M2, M1. And so in these different regimes, we do have a running coupling constant. And in n equals 1 supersymmetric theories, as I hope you've studied, then they're actually, well, then at least in some renormalization schemes, one can trust the exact one loop formulas for the running of the coupling constant. So we can compute what's the scale lambda super Young-Mills that we end up with here as a function of the Young-Mills squared that we start with and of these 3 masses just by first matching. So at this scale, we go over from the n equals 4 Young-Mills to a theory that has just 2 adjoint fields, and we can match the couplings of these 2 theories at the scale M3. Then we run the coupling down to here, and then we match the couplings at the scale M2 and so on. So that's a standard technique. And if you do this, and so if you do follow the renormalization group flow all the way down to very low energies, what you find is that this lambda super Young-Mills of the n equals 1 theory turns out to be given by M1 times M2 times M3 times e to the minus h pi squared divided by Young-Mills squared n. So for here, I'm just repeatedly using in each of these regimes the usual formula for the running of the coupling, which says that lambda over the renormalization scale to the power of b, where b is the coefficient of the one loop coupling constants, goes like e to the minus h pi squared over Young-Mills squared at the scale mu times n. And then just Young-Mills squared. And then just repeatedly using this formula for matching the couplings first at the scale M3, then M2 and M1 gives this formula. And of course, you can see that this formula is consistent on dimensional grounds, so that lambda cubed scales like the masses cubed. And that, of course, has to be true because we had a conformal theory, and the only thing that breaks conformal invariance is these masses. So any mass scale that we compute has to be proportional to these masses. But the interesting thing is this proportionality coefficient, which turns out to be, at least in some renormalization scheme, exactly e to the minus 8 pi squared divided by Young-Mills squared n. And so what we see is that the question of whether these scales are separated or not depends on the value of Young-Mills squared n. So we see that if this lambda of the n equals 4 Young-Mills theory, which is Young-Mills squared n, we see that if this lambda is much smaller than 1, then this exponent is very small. So in that regime, lambda, the coupling constant of the super Young-Mills, sorry, the dynamical scale of the super Young-Mills theory is much smaller than mi. And in this regime, our naive expectation is correct, and we would flow at low energies to the n equals 1 Young-Mills theory. So a reminder that in the language that we discussed before, then the scale mi is exactly the scale which I called lambda nu before. And this lambda lambda super Young moles plays the role of the scale of the theory that we want to be in. So we see that in this regime of lambda of the two-fifth coupling much smaller than one, then we do have a large separation between this lambda nu and lambda super Young moles. So we do realize our naive expectation to flow to the n equals one super Young moles, but of course, in this regime, we know that we don't have a good supergravity approximation. So even at high energies in this regime, we don't have a good supergravity approximation. We're highly curved, so we don't really know what we're doing. However, in the opposite regime of lambda much bigger than one, then this exponent, well, the thing sitting here in the exponent is of order zero, so lambda super Young moles is of the same order as the MI, and we don't really have a separation of scales. So in this case, the scale lambda nu, where we get these additional degrees of freedom of the n equals four Young moles theory, all these added chiral multiplets, they come in at exactly the same scale as the degrees of freedom that we want to study, all the confined degrees of freedom of the super Young moles theory. So in this case, our naive expectation is wrong, and we see that we don't really have a separation of scales that allows us to flow purely to the n equals one super Young moles theory. Now, of course, this should not be surprising because this is completely in line with the general discussion that we did before. We expect that we should only, well, that obviously whenever supergravity is valid, we should not be able to really describe separately just the degrees of freedom of the n equals one Young moles without adding more degrees of freedom. And that's what happens in this first case. In the second case, we see that there isn't any separation between the degrees of freedom. But the upside of that is that in this case, it might be the case that supergravity is valid, so we don't know yet because we haven't discussed it, this deformation on the string theory side. But here, at least at high energies, supergravity is valid because we're strong coupling. And in this regime, one could hope to have a good supergravity description of this background. So we are here in exactly this situation that we described before, where there's one limit, the limit of small lambda, where we get the theory that we're interested in, either n equals one Young moles, or if we give four masses, n equals zero Young moles. And there's an opposite limit where we hope to be able to control the theory using supergravity and see its qualitative properties. And of course, eventually we'll also want to find some way to interpolate between these regimes, but that's going to be harder to do. So we'll focus on studying this this regime of strong coupling. Are there any questions about this? Okay, so I've already mentioned one problem with this naive expectation of flowing to n equals one super Young moles. Actually, there's another potential problem with this naive expectation, which is that we have to check whether the gauge group is broken or not, because we have here these scalar fields, and in principle, they could also break the gauge group, and we might end up in just a theory which would be in a Higgs phase and not in a confining phase. So we have to analyze the vacuum structure of this theory to see whether the gauge symmetry is broken or not. And obviously, we want to be in the case where it's not broken so that we could really flow to the n equals one Young moles theory, at least when we're tweak coupling and we know what we're talking about. And it turns out that this theory described by this simple potential actually has many discrete vacua, which exhibit various different, so these are all discrete supersymmetric vacua. And they exhibit various different patterns of gauge symmetry breaking. And the way to see that is that, as I hope you've already studied in the school, to find supersymmetric vacua, we have to find solutions to the F-term equations, dW by d phi I equals zero, and then divide the space of solutions to these equations by the complexified gauge group. That gives us the list of supersymmetric vacua, and in this case, the complexified gauge group is SLNC, which is the complexification of SUN. Yes? Well, so the correspondence holds at any value of the coupling. So just like in n equals four Young moles, we had a correspondence both at weak coupling and at strong coupling, but only at weak coupling we could use perturbation theory, only at strong coupling we could use gravity, but there was a correspondence for any value of the coupling. So similarly also here, I can start with any coupling that I want and then add these masses and I can study what that leads to. And we see that if I'm at weak coupling, then then there will be a correspondence still, and the correspondence will give me the Young-Mills theory, but I'll be at high curvature, so I won't know what to do. If I'm at strong coupling, then we see that I won't be able to separate the Young-Mills theory, but maybe I'll be able to use supergravity as an approximation. So, but the correspondence is going to apply for any value of lambda, just like in the original n equals 4 theory, we had a correspondence for any value of lambda. But again, we can only compute in some specific limits. Any other questions? Okay, so let's find the supersymmetric vacua. So we just have to solve these equations, and by using this superpotential, it's easy to see that these equations can be written in the form of commutator phi I phi j. That's what comes from the first term here, is equal to minus m over square root 2 epsilon I j k phi k, where this second term comes from this mass term. So here I've taken all the masses to be equal. It doesn't really matter. We can always, well, by rescaling the kinetic terms of these fields, we can always choose the masses to be equal. And the analysis will be very similar also if I take unequal masses, but for simplicity, I'll just take all these masses to be equal. It doesn't really change anything qualitative. So this is the F-term equation of motion. And what we see is that up to this factor of m over square root 2, this is, so of course, these phis are all n by n matrices. And this equation is just the defining equation for a representation of SU2. So this is just the same relation which is obeyed by the SU2 generators. So we see that if we look at the matrices square root 2 times phi divided by m, then they'll actually obey precisely the equation which is the defining equation for a representation of SU2. So these matrices are a representation of SU2. And since these matrices phi I are n-dimensional matrices, when we're working in an SUN gauge theory, that means that these matrices have to be an n-dimensional representation of SU2. And that's, so the phis have to be an n-dimensional representation of SU2, and every n-dimensional representation gives us a vacuum just by plugging it into this equation. So the list of, so of course, I should emphasize, of course, I'm starting here by just finding the classical vacua. So this, of course, is the requirement for classical vacuum of the theory. We'll add the quantum effects in a moment, but for now I'm just discussing the classical vacua. And so we see that the list of classical vacua is the same as the list of n-dimensional representations of SU2. And of course, these representations don't have to be irreducible. I mean, if we were talking about an irreducible representation, then there's only one of dimension n, but nothing in this equation tells us that the representation has to be irreducible. So the general solution to these equations would be to take the matrices phi I to be some product of representations, and we can always diagonalize the block, so we would have, say, some representation of rank n1, a representation of dimension n2, and so on. And this would be the general solution. And again, we can always set to zero the matrices outside these blocks. And in these blocks, just write down the n1 dimensional representation, then two dimensional representation, and so on. That we can always do by using these complexified Gates transformation. So generally, we have some list of numbers in I, which sum up to n. And so if you want, there is also a mapping between the classical vacua and the partitions of n into some list of integers. So that gives us these vacua. Now, in many of these vacua, so one case of these vacua, a special case, is the case where we just have one block of size n. That's the vacuum of the n-dimensional representation. In this case, the gauge group is already classically completely broken by this VEV. So that's actually a case that we're not going to be very interested in, because we want to preserve this gauge group and to actually discuss a case where we get the QCD theory of thermal energies, but still it will be useful to also discuss this case. This case is called the Higgs vacuum, because already classically the gauge group is completely broken. If you look in all other vacua, the gauge group, some gauge coupling is preserved. So some of the gauge group is preserved. For instance, if you look at a vacuum with two blocks, then you can see that you always preserve some U1, which is given by some constant matrix in the first block and another constant matrix in the second block that gives you some U1 generator of SU2, of SUN, sorry, which is not broken. in this theory. So in all the other vacua, there is some component of the gauge group which is preserved. And of course, the most extreme case is the case where we just take n blocks of the one-dimensional representation of SU2. So the most extreme case is where we take all these ni to be 1, and then of course the classical solution is just phi I equals 0. So that's of course a special case of a solution to these matrices where we just take the trivial one-dimensional representation of SU2. And this is the vacuum that, so classically in this vacuum, we preserve the full SUN, because we don't have any VEV for any of the scalars. And that's, of course, the vacuum that we're most interested in, because we really want the SUN to be preserved, also with low energies, in order to be able to flow to either the pre-Riemann-Mills theory or the SUN, or the N equals 1 supersymmetric Young-Mills theory. Now, this is the classical picture. So classically, we have this list of vacua. Quantum mechanically, then things would be slightly different. I mean, in the Higgs vacuum, we don't really expect anything to change, because here the SUN is just classically broken and there aren't any strong interactions remaining at low energies. So this Higgs vacuum, we don't expect to be modified by quantum effects. However, in this vacuum, we do expect modifications, because here at low energies, we're still left with the massless fields of the N equals 1 super Young-Mills theory. And I hope that you studied this last week, but there are many arguments that the N equals 1 super Young-Mills theory actually has n different vacua. So it's if we were working here in the limit of small lambda, then at low energies, we would really just have the N equals 1 Young-Mills theory, and we can use the analysis of how that theory behaves quantum mechanically, which is well known. So that theory has n different vacua, which are distinguished by the VEV of the Gugino condensate, trace lambda lambda, and which involves the spontaneous breaking of some U1R symmetry, which is anomalous and is broken. So let me just remind you that if we had just the pure N equals 1 super Young-Mills theory, that's a theory that classically has a U1R symmetry, which acts on the phase of the fermion in the theory, the gluino. This theory is anomalous and broken by an anomaly to Z2n. And then in the supersymmetric vacua, this symmetry is further broken spontaneously to Z2. And obviously, whenever one has such a symmetry breaking of Z2n to Z2, one has n different vacua, which are distinguished by the phase of any operator which is charged under this Z2n, such as this gluino condensate trace lambda lambda. In the context of this N equals 4 theory that we start from, we don't really have a U1R symmetry. The deformation that we did breaks all of the global symmetries, but as I mentioned, if we're at recoupling and at low energies, we should flow to the same theory, so we still expect to have n different vacua here, even though there's no longer an exact symmetry that relates them. So what we see is that even though classically we have one vacuum for every representation of, for every n-dimensional representation of SU2, quantum mechanically we actually have more vacua because here we see that a single classical vacuum in the quantum theory, it becomes n different vacua. So in fact, we're in an even worse situation and the number of vacua is even larger. And similarly, another interesting case to look at is the case where all the ni are equal, but they're not equal to 1, but rather equal to some other value. So we can look at the case where, say, all the ni are equal to q, and that's possible if n is decomposable as p times q with some integers p and q, then we can just take p different blocks, each of which are of size q. And this vacuum is interesting because in this vacuum, the SUN symmetry is broken by the Higgs mechanism down to an SUP subgroup, where this SUP just acts by rotations of the different blocks. So we have here p different blocks and all the any generator of SUN, which is constant in all these blocks, is unbroken. So the SUN is completely broken to SUP classically. And then quantum mechanically, we expect that this will lead to p different vacua because one can show that the low energy theory in this case is just the pure SUP Young-Mills theory and that has p different vacua. So this is another case where we get where the quantum effects increase the number of vacua. I should mention that these vacua that we get here are called confining vacua, So these are just names, but because the n equals 1 theory is believed to confine ethernities, then these vacua are called confining vacua. Well, as I said, this one is called the Higgs vacuum. And all the other vacua are mixed in some sense. For instance, in these vacua, the SUN is broken by the Higgs mechanism to SUP, but the SUP that confines, so that's some example of a mixed Higgs confining vacua. And there are also, of course, and well, these cases turn out to be the most interesting because whenever we have at least two blocks that have a different size, then there's always at least some U1 gauge field that's unbroken ethernities. So of course here we have these many U1s, but they're enhanced to this non-abelian SUP. Well, if we have blocks of different size, then there's a U1 ethernities which is not enhanced. And then in those cases, so well here, so in all other vacua, we have at least one U1 gauge field remaining at low energies. And when we have U1 fields at low energies, then they don't become strongly coupled because the U1 theory is not asymptotically free. They become weakly coupled at low energies. So in those cases, we have no mass gap. In these vacua, there are always at least some massless fields remaining, which are at least these U1 gauge field. While, of course, we're mostly interested in vacua that will have a mass gap. Because we want to eventually describe theories in the same universality class as this n equals 1 super Young-Mohs theory that has a mass gap. So I'm going to focus on these classes of vacua. So this Higgs vacuum, already classically, it has a mass gap. Classically, all the gauge symmetry is broken, all the W bosons get a mass, and also all the scalar fields get a mass, and some of them are swallowed by the Higgs mechanism, some are not. So this vacuum already classically has a mass gap. In these vacua, one can argue that quantum mechanically they have a mass gap, and similarly in these vacua. So these are the vacua that we're going to be interested in. So this is the field theory analysis of what happens after this deformation. We see that we have many vacua, and we, for the purposes of getting to the Young-Mohs theory, we want to focus on these confining vacua, though, of course, when we do this deformation on the string theory side, we should be able to identify all of these vacua. So each of these vacua should have some mapping to a string theory, and we should be able to describe it. So here I've described just some general properties of these vacua. I should emphasize that here, because of supersymmetry, actually many things are known about all these vacua of the n equals 4 mass deformed theory. One can compute the expectation values of basically all the chiral operators in each of these vacua. There are techniques using holomorphy and so on, and using also the electromagnetic duality of the n equals 4 theory. Then there are very sophisticated techniques, which mean that we already, from the field theory side, we really know how to compute many things in all of these vacua, including the vibes of chiral operators and things like that. And of course, we should be able to reproduce all these computations also from the string theory side if we find a string dual of this theory. One final comment from the field theory side is that this was all for the supersymmetric case. If we look at a non-supersymmetric case, then of course we don't expect to find this big degeneracy of vacua. That's only a property of supersymmetric theories. So if we break supersymmetry and take M4 to be non-zero, then we expect to just have a single vacuum because there's no reason to have a degeneracy anymore. But we could still have more metastable vacua. So for instance, if we start from this, if we go to the n equals zero case by first giving a large mass to these three chiral superfields in this way, and then just adding an additional small deformation that gives a small mass M4 to the Gluino, then in such a case, then say the energies of these vacua will only change by a little bit when we add this small M4. So because these vacua are all stable in the supersymmetric theory, then at least when we do a small deformation of it, these vacua will still be stable, at least the ones that have a mass gap. So there could be, in some cases, additional metastable vacua. And as I said, that's what will happen if we start from small large masses and give just a small mass to the fourth fermion. But we expect that, again, the vacuum energies, after we break supersymmetry, the vacuum energies of all these many different vacua will start changing, and they won't be the same anymore, and only one of them will have the lowest energy and will be the real vacuum state of this theory. Of course, once we break supersymmetry, we don't really have any good tools to control the computations, and even it's not really known even how to compute the vacuum energy of the theory without supersymmetry and so on. So much less is known about the non-supersymmetric cases, but But of course, phenomenologically, they're more interesting, so I'll mention these as well. So this concludes my discussion of the field theory side of the duality, and next we'll try to find what's the string theory dual of this. So are there any questions about the field theory side? Okay, so in order to find the string theory dual of this, then of course we're going to use the fact that we already know what's the dual of the theory of the no masses. So as we've described, for the n equals 4 theory with no masses, then we know that the dual is just type 2B string theory on ADS5 cross S5 with the parameters of the two sides related as I wrote before. And what we need to do is to find a way to realize this deformation of the Lagrangian also on the string theory side. So I'm not sure if you've already seen this in the lectures, in the previous lectures on ADS-CFT or not, but one way to phrase the ADS-CFT correspondence, at least in the gravity approximation, is to say that the generating function of the correlation functions in this n equals 4 super Young-Mills theory. So one can always take this n equals 4 super Young-Mills theory and deform it by arbitrary operators OI and write down this generating function. That's, of course, a standard thing that we do in field theory. And then we can always, and then the expectation value of this is some functional of these lambda I's. And we can compute expectation values of products of operators by computing the derivative of this function at lambda equals 0. That will give us the correlation functions in the n equals 4 Young-Mills. And what this maps to, say, in the supergravity approximation is to the partition function of the type 2B supergravity on ADS5 cross S5 with specific boundary conditions for the field. So as you've seen in previous lectures, each operator, at least each, as I mentioned, each chiral primary single trace operator, OI in the field theory, maps to some field that lives on this anti-de Sitter space. So there's a one-to-one mapping between operators in the field theory and fields living on anti-de Sitter space. So I'll denote, say, that these fields by chi I. And these chi I's are functions of x and z, where I'm going to use the following metric for anti-de Sitter space. So I'll write the metric of anti-de Sitter space as dx mu plus dz squared over z squared. So that's a specific choice of the metric on anti-de Sitter space, where z is the radial direction in the space, and for z equals 0, we go to the boundary. And so these x's label the coordinates of the field theory, which can be taken to be on some four-dimensional flat space, and this z is the radial coordinate. And one aspect of the ADS-CFT correspondence is that this generating function maps to the partition function of the Young-Mills theory, where these fields in the limit as one goes to the boundary should behave as lambda I of x times z to the power 4 minus delta I, where the delta I are the dimensions of these operators OI. So you've probably seen this formula that the dimension of this operator times the dimension minus 4 is equal to the mass squared times the radius of ADS squared of these fields chi I on anti-de Sitter space. And by solving the field equations, one can show that the behavior of these fields near the boundary has to be like z to the power 4 minus delta I times some function. And one expression of the ADS-CFT correspondence is that this generating function in the field theory is the same as this partition function of string theory with these specific boundary conditions. And then if we want to compute correlation functions, then we just need to insert, say, lambdas, which are some delta function sources at some points, and take the derivatives with respect to them. And on the gravity side, that means that we put in sources at some points on the boundary, and the computation involves bulk to boundary propagators and things like that. So I'm not sure if you've seen in previous lectures a discussion of these correlation functions, but anyway, I won't really be using the correlation functions in this talk. I'll just be using this this general formula, which, again, it tells us how to relate deformations of this type of the n equals 4 Lagrangian, which are useful for computing correlation functions, to things that we do in supergravity, namely changing the boundary conditions on the fields. Now, as I mentioned, so this formula is one of the ways to phrase the ADS-CFT correspondence. And usually, in the context of just doing ADS-CFT, if one wants to compute correlators, then usually one uses this formula by putting in some infinitesimal sources lambda and computing the derivatives of this generating function with respect to the lambdas at lambda equals 0. So usually, for the purpose of computing correlation functions, one only uses this formula for infinitesimal lambdas. But in fact, this formula is true also for non-infinitesimal lambdas. And in particular, what we want to do now, as we said, is we want to add to our Lagrangian some operators like these operators of mass, or this mass of the fermions. So this is some specific operator OI. And we want to add to the Lagrangian this specific source MA for this operator. And this formula tells us how we're supposed to do this. So we just take this lambda I of x for this specific operator to be equal to MA, independently of x, of course, because we want a deformation that preserves Lorentz invariants. So we have to, so this operator OI maps to some specific field chi in the type 2B supergravity. And it turns out that this field chi is actually some mode of the NSNS2 form, or some linear combination of the NSNS2 form, BAB, and the Ramon-Ramon 2 form, CAB, with some indices that belong to the S5. So of course, this operator is a scalar operator in the n equals 4 Young-Mills theory, so it should map to some scalar field on ADS5. But in this case, this scalar field in 5 dimensions comes from a 2 form field in 10 dimensions, where we take 2 of the indices of these 2 forms to lie in the S5 directions. And so there's some specific spherical harmonic in the expansion of the B field and of the C field, which corresponds to this field chi I. The reason that we need both B and C is because this field is complex, and also this operator in the field theory is complex. So we need a combination of 2 fields. So we know what this operator is. That's already a statement about just the n equals 4 theory. And then if we want to find what's the supergravity or string theory which is dual to this deformation, then we just have to find a configuration. So we need to find a configuration where this field chi I will go as z goes to 0. Then it should just behave like m times z. So the role of the lambda is played in this case by m, which is the coefficient of the deformation. And because this operator has dimension 3, then this is the type of behavior that we get near the boundary. So the ADS-CFT tells us that supergravity solutions with this boundary condition are the duals to this deformation of taking the Lagrangian and adding to it these mass terms, trace lambda lambda. Of course, I'm describing this here in the supergravity limit. In principle, we could also do this deformation in the full string theory. So also in the full string theory, each of these operators OI should also map to some operator on the string world sheet. And so each of these OIs maps to some vertex operator on the string world sheet, say D2W. So there's some vertex operator of VI, which is a functional of X and also depends on the world sheet position. And these operators OI will map to some string theory vertex operator integrated over the world sheet. And then if we want to do this deformation in string theory, then we would be instructed to take the world sheet Lagrangian and the string theory and add to it m times the integral both over x and over the world sheet of this vertex operator of x and w. So in principle, we also know how to do this deformation in the full string theory. But unfortunately, we don't have good control over string theory in ADS5 plus S5. We don't really know how to quantize it. So that's why I'm discussing these deformations just in the supergravity approximation. And in the supergravity approximation, we just have to find solutions with these boundary conditions. So are there any questions about this? Yes. So can you talk louder? That's right. So So this is the deformation that we're doing its leading order, and then it's true that we also have to add some specific operators involving the scalar. Say if you want to do the supersymmetric deformation, we have to do this. We have to add some specific masses for the scalars, but so first of all, of course, so this is true if we don't want supersymmetry. Say if we just add fermion masses, then this is true as it is. But if we want to also add the scalar masses, then, well, one thing to do is to follow carefully exactly which scalar masses we add and also put in the appropriate boundary conditions for these fields. But a simpler way to do this is just to look at solutions that preserves n equals 1 supersymmetry also in the gravity side. And that will ensure that if I find a solution like this that still has n equals 1 supersymmetry, then that ensures that it maps to the theory where it really didn't add just this, but also added the specific scalar masses which are necessary to ensure supersymmetry. So I actually don't have to, so if I'm just looking at supersymmetric solutions, I don't have to separately follow the scalars and see how they behave. I can just look for solutions that preserve n equals 1 supersymmetry. And of course, I remind you that the original supergravity solution here preserved 32 supercharges, which are the n equals 4 supersymmetry and also the n equals 4 superconformal invariants. So originally, we had 32 supercharges. Here, these solutions are supposed to preserve just n equals 1 supersymmetry and no superconformal symmetry because we're breaking explicitly the conformal symmetry. So we're looking for solutions that preserve only 4 supercharges. But in principle, that's what we're supposed to do. Any other questions? Yes. Sorry?
What?
Well, the reason for choosing this deformation is the reason that I explained before. We want to get to pure Young-Mills theory, so we want to give a mass. And this is the simplest way to get rid of the fermions, and just by giving them a mass. Of course, I could also look at various other operators that I can add, but this is the thing that, in the most straightforward way, just gets rid of the fermions and leaves us just with a pure Young-Mills theory, which we want. Any other questions? Okay, so at first sight, everything looks simple, and we just need to find what these solutions are. So we need to find supergravity solutions that preserve supersymmetry with some specific boundary conditions. That just involves solving classical equations of motion, and if one has n equals 1 supersymmetry, you can even just solve first-order equations and not second-order equations. So it's not too hard to do. Unfortunately, if one tries to do this and really follow these rules and construct these supergravity solutions, so people did this, and unfortunately, what this leads to is singular solutions. So one might have hoped that these deformations would be described by some smooth supergravity background. As I said, a priori, we don't know whether these strongly coupled deformed theories should be well described by supergravity or not, but we were hoping that they could have a description purely in terms of supergravity. But unfortunately, if we try to find these solutions, then it turns out that there's actually a family of solutions with these boundary conditions, which all preserve supersymmetry. But unfortunately, all of these solutions are singular. So the supergravity, of course, breaks down whenever we have a singularity. We can't use supergravity anymore. So that tells us that we have to do something more than just use supergravity. Of course, it's not too surprising that we found a family of solutions, because here I haven't specified yet which vacuum of the field theory I'm in. So as we saw for large n, there's really a huge number of vacua in this theory, which is even bigger than the number of partitions of n, which itself is a huge number for large n. So it's not so surprising that there should be many solutions with these boundary conditions. That we certainly expect to be true even in the full theory. But unfortunately, if we try to analyze these solutions just using supergravity, then we find that they're singular. So we have to go beyond supergravity and be smarter than just doing the naive thing of solving the classical supergravity equations. So, of course, when we have singular solutions, then we need to try to resolve the singularity in some way. It tells us that we're doing something wrong, and we have to add some more stuff to the theory that will resolve the singularity. And so we need to look for hints for what is it that we're missing here. So, of course, one possibility is that the theory just really becomes highly curved, and we really have to solve the full string theory, and then this would not really be useful, because it wouldn't be better than just trying to directly find the strongly curved theory of QCD. So the hope is that that's not the case, and that we don't really have to deal with strong curvature, but that we can still find some weakly curved solutions. But obviously, they can't just be given by supergravity. So what could they be? So there are two hints as to what we're missing in the supergravity analysis. Actually, well, this may be a good place to stop, I guess, and continue tomorrow. So let me just summarize what we've done so far. So again, so I've described in detail what these deformations do on the field theory side. We saw that there's this long list of vacua with various properties. And as I said, each of these vacua should have some string theory dual for any value of lambda. And then on the ADS side, we saw that the way to find these solutions is to find solutions of gravity that have this boundary condition. But if we try to do this naively, we end up with singular solutions. So we have to be less naive. And I guess it's an exercise for tomorrow to think about how one can be less naive here. And tomorrow we'll see how to resolve these singularities. So any further questions up to now? OK, so we'll continue tomorrow.